Chapter 121. The French priests pay their respects. A day or two after the events just related, we were lounging in the Calabouza Baratini, when we were honored by a visit from three of the French priests, and as about the only notice ever taken of us by the English missionaries was their leaving their cards for us, in the shape of a package of tracts, we could not help thinking that the Frenchmen, in making a personal call, were at least much better bred. By this time they had settled themselves down quite near our habitation. A pleasant little stroll down the broom road, and a rustic cross peeped through the trees, and soon you came to as charming a place as one would wish to see. A soft knoll, planted with old breadfruit trees, in front, a savanna, sloping to a grove of palms, and, between these, glimpses of blue, sunny waves. On the summit of the knoll, was a rude chapel, of bamboos, quite small, unsurmounted by the cross. Between the canes, at nightfall, the natives stole peeps at a small portable altar, a crucifix to correspond, and gilded candlesticks and censers. Their curiosity carried them no further. Nothing could induce them to worship there. Such queer ideas as they entertained of the hated strangers. Masses and chants were nothing more than evil spells. As for the priests themselves, they were no better than diabolical sorcerers, like those who, in old times, terrified their fathers. Close by the chapel was a range of native houses, rented from a chief, and handsomely furnished. Here lived the priests, and very comfortably too. They looked sanctimonious enough abroad, but that went for nothing. Since, at home, in their retreat, they were a club of friar tucks, holding priestly wassail over many a good cup of red brandy, and rising late in the morning. Pity it was they couldn't marry, pity for the ladies of the island, I mean, and the cause of morality, for what business had the ecclesiastical old bachelors with such a set of trim little native handmaidens? These damsels were their first converts, and devoted ones they were. The priests, as I have said before, were accounted necromancers. The appearance of two of our three visitors might have justified the conceit. They were little, dried-up Frenchmen, in long, straight gowns of black cloth, and unsightly three-cornered hats so preposterously big that, in putting them on, the Reverend Father seemed to extinguish themselves. Their companion was dressed differently. He wore a sort of yellow, flannel morning gown, and a broad-brimmed manila hat. Large and portly, he was also hale and 50, with a complexion like an autumnal leaf, handsome blue eyes, fine teeth, and a racy Milesian brogue. In short, he was an Irishman, Father Murphy, by name, and, as such, pretty well known, and very thoroughly disliked, throughout all the Protestant missionary settlements in Polynesia. In early youth, he had been sent to a religious seminary in France, and, taking orders there, had but once or twice afterwards revisited his native land. Father Murphy marched up to us briskly, and the first words he uttered were, to ask whether there were any of his countrymen among us. There were two of them. One, a lad of 16, a bright, curly-headed rascal and, being a young Irishman, of course, his name was Pat. The other was an ugly, and rather melancholy-looking scamp, one G, whose prospects in life had been blasted by a premature transportation to Sydney. This was the report, at least, though it might have been scandal. In most of my shipmates were some redeeming qualities. But about G, there was nothing of the kind, and forced to consort with him, I could not help regretting, a thousand times, that the gallows had been so tardy. As if impelled, against her will, to send him into the world, nature had done all she could to ensure his being taken for what he was. About the eyes there was no mistaking him, with a villainous cast in one, they seemed suspicious of each other. Glancing away from him at once, the bluff priest rested his gaze on the good-humored face of Pat, who, with a pleasant roguishness, was twigging the enormous hats or E.T. belt teasers, as land beavers are called by sailors, from under which, like a couple of snails, peeped the two little Frenchmen. Pat and the priest were both from the same town in Meath, and, when this was found out, there was no end to the questions of the latter. To him, Pat seemed a letter from home, and said 100 times as much. After a long talk between these two, and a little broken English from the Frenchman, our visitors took leave. But Father Murphy had hardly gone 12 rods when back he came, inquiring whether we were in want of anything. "Yes," cried one, "something to eat." Upon this he promised to send us some fresh wheat bread, of his own baking, a great luxury in Tahiti. We all felicitated Pat upon picking up such a friend, and told him his fortune was made. The next morning, a French servant of the priest's made his appearance with a small bundle of clothing for our young Hibernian, and the promised bread for the party. Pat being out at the knees and elbows, and, like the rest of us, not full inside, the present was acceptable all round. In the afternoon, Father Murphy himself came along, and, in addition to his previous gifts, gave Pat a good deal of advice. Said he was sorry to see him in limbo, and that he would have a talk with the consul about having him set free. We saw nothing more of him for 2 or 3 days, at the end of which time he paid us another call, telling Pat that Wilson was inexorable, having refused to set him at liberty, unless to go aboard the ship. This, the priest now besought him to do forthwith, and so escape the punishment which, it seems, Wilson had been hinting at to his intercessor. Pat, however, was staunch against entreaties, and, with all the ardor of a sophomorean sailor, protested his intention to hold out to the last. With none of the meekness of a good little boy about him, the blunt youngster stormed away at such a rate that it was hard to pacify him, and the priest said no more. How it came to pass, whether from Murphy speaking to the consul, or otherwise, we could not tell, but the next day, Pat was sent for by Wilson, and being escorted to the village by our good old keeper, 3 days elapsed before he returned. Bent upon reclaiming him, they had taken him on board the ship, feasted him in the cabin, and, finding that of no avail, down they thrust him into the hold, in double irons, and on bread and water. All would not do, and so he was sent back to the Calabooza. Boy that he was, they must have counted upon his being more susceptible to discipline than the rest. The interest felt in Pat's welfare, by his benevolent countrymen, was very serviceable to the rest of us, especially as we all turned Catholics, and went to Mass every morning, much to Captain Bob's consternation. Upon finding it out, he threatened to keep us in the stocks, if we did not desist. He went no farther than this, though, and so, every few days, we strolled down to the priest's residence, and had a mouthful to eat, and something generous to drink. In particular, Dr. Long Ghost and myself became huge favorites with Pat's friend, and many a time he regaled us from a quaint-looking traveling case for spirits, stowed away in one corner of his dwelling. It held 4 square flasks, which, somehow or other, always contained just enough to need emptying. In truth, the fine old Irishman was a rosy fellow in canonicals. His countenance and his soul were always in a glow. It may be ungenerous to reveal his failings, but he often talked thick, and sometimes was perceptibly eccentric in his gait. I never drink French brandy, but I pledge Father Murphy his health again. And many jolly proselytes may he make in Polynesia. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.